can't talk, but these guys can. You're listening to Elephant Talk on CHLY 101.7. Oh, hi, is that Bob
Bellamy? All right, I'm going to give you a little background, a little cool little story here. This is from a book called Cannabis by Martin Booth. Once upon a time, according to a story recounted by the Islamic chronicler Al-Markrizi, who lived 1364 to 1442, in AD 1155, the founder of the Persian Sufi Haydari sect, Haydar, left his cell in a monastery in the mountains near Nishawar, in the Khorasan region of northeastern Iran. This monk went for a walk. Discovering a plant standing unwithered by the blazing sun, he grew curious and wondered how it withstood the desiccating heat. So he cut a few leaves of the plant and chewed on them as he went on his way. Usually a taciturn man, he returned in a fickle frame of mind with a smile on his face. Swearing his fellow monks to secrecy, he told them what he had discovered. Thereafter, it is said, he remained in a capricious mood until his death 66 years later. What he had purportedly discovered was a drug from a common plant. The plant was cannabis. So, like I said, that's from a book that I'm just digging into called Cannabis by Martin Booth. And we have on the line with us now Dr. Robert Melamed. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Well, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
And taking some time out of your weekend. So I was very interested, as I said to you on the phone, to hear your interview with Mr. Dean Becker.
Yeah.
You were saying a lot of things about cannabis that I've never heard before, and I've heard a few of them. Mostly about the existence of the cannabinoid system, which I've just read here, has been around for over 600 million years. So can you tell us what this is?
And what a cannabinoid is? I've never even heard this word before.
Well, cannabinoid simply means a chemical that binds to what we have identified over the past 10 years or so, THC receptors. The reason marijuana works is because our brains and other parts of our bodies have receptors, and when THC binds to those receptors, it changes the biochemistry of those cells. And in particular in the brain, it's your nerve cells that get affected. But the logical question then is, well, why do we have cannabinoid receptors, THC receptors, in our brain? Not so that we can get high from a plant, but rather because the properties of THC are simply mimicking things that are occurring in our brains. And it turns out that we make THC-like compounds. It's not the same chemical structure, but they're similar in that they bind to the THC receptors of our brain. So we make these compounds. They're all made from, actually from essential fatty acids. And they probably have a lot to do with the beneficial effects that people get from eating omega-3s, you know, the oils that are in fish.
Hmm. Uh-huh.
So we're making these cannabinoids, and literally, since they've been around for so long, as you mentioned, 600 million years, as evolution proceeded, what you find is that the cannabinoids participated in the evolutionary advances, so that they became very fundamental molecules in the balancing act that characterizes life. You know, everything's a balance of opposing forces. Think of it kind of as a thermostat. When the thermostat, when the room gets cold, the thermostat senses it, and then it makes it warmer, and then it gets to the level that you set the thermostat, and then it shuts off the heater, right? Well, we have similar kinds of phenomena occurring in our body where there's many, many thousands of different kinds of balancing acts that are occurring, each with their own little thermostats. And the cannabinoid system, meaning the marijuana-like compounds that our body produces, are very much involved in many of those thermostatic-like processes.
When,
so,
sorry,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to back up here and properly introduce you so that people can sort of feel the weight of your words. You are the chairman of the biology department at the University of Colorado.
And, at Colorado Springs, yes.
Okay, and from what I understand, you've written a lot of things about a lot of different subjects pertaining to biology.
not just about the cannabinoid system. So, what I wonder is, well, first of all, how long have we known about the cannabinoid system? When was it discovered to be a system in the body?
Well, the receptors were first discovered, I think, around 1994, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere in that early 90s. And what was a problem was to find why they were there, to find the natural chemicals that our bodies make. So the receptors were discovered by making some radioactive THC and then finding that the radioactive THC was binding very specifically to certain areas in the brain. Hmm. But then the question was, well, you know, what are we making that does the same thing? And because they're fat compounds, they're lipids, those are a little more difficult to work with. And it took a number of years before the first endocannabinoid was discovered, endo within and cannabinoid marijuana-like. So once those pieces started to be discovered, then, of course, a variety of researchers tried to find chemicals that they could produce that would have similar effects. So now we have the cannabinoids that we find in plants, we have cannabinoids that our bodies produce, and we have synthetic ones that have been produced for medical and research purposes as well.
So what are some of these other cannabinoids? Do they only exist in cannabis?
Well, cannabis produces about 60 compounds that are related to the chemical structure of THC. They don't all have psychoactive properties. They don't all bind to the THC receptors. And then you have, so the thing that's quite unique about marijuana is it's the only plant that makes cannabinoids, that makes THC. And therefore, it's the only plant on the whole planet that can tap into our endocannabinoid system by binding to those receptors. So it's got a very unique potential by virtue of that fact. And if you look in general at what the cannabinoids are doing, the ones that we make, they regulate really free radical production. And free radicals, you know, everybody knows they take vitamin C and vitamin E. We take antioxidants, right? Mm-hmm. Well, antioxidants are designed to counteract the effects of free radicals. Free radicals are compounds that react very readily with literally everything in our body. So they affect our proteins, they affect our lipids, they affect our carbohydrates, but probably most importantly, they affect our DNA and our RNA. And they can cause mutations. And they're something that's unavoidable because they're produced by the fact that we consume food and we burn that food by combining it with oxygen. And along the way, you get some sloppiness, and that sloppiness is the free radical.
So it's sort of a natural byproduct of our body just doing its thing.
Absolutely. But the thing that becomes critical, well, if you want to understand the potential importance of marijuana and of this endocannabinoid system, is that the longer you live, the more air you've been breathing, the more food you've been consuming, the more free radicals you make, and the more they have the potential to do damage.
So, and what sort of damage? Like, are they related to, is it cancer or aging?
Or? Well, you know, there's age-related diseases. And what are they? Well, we all, you know, just look around you. What are the common things that you see happening to people as they get older? They have cardiovascular disease that leads to heart failure, for example. They have autoimmune diseases, which manifest itself, for example, as arthritis or as diabetes or as multiple sclerosis or as Crohn's disease. So we have a variety of autoimmune diseases. And then in addition, we have neurological deterioration, things like Alzheimer's disease. And then as well, we have cancers that are the result of, you know, being exposed during your life, not only to the free radicals that we make naturally, but also to the various chemicals that are in our environment.
Mm. And so what is the relation between free radicals and cannabinoids and therefore possibly cannabis?
Right. Well, it turns out that I have a very simple way of viewing the whole thing. Free radicals are the friction of life because they actually kind of like rust, you know, or friction in general in a motor. It wears things out. Well, it wears out our biochemistry, the efficiency of our biochemistry. And what marijuana does and what our endocannabinoids do, those are the oil of life. They help reduce the friction.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And keep the engine running a little longer.
They exist in our body, but they're enhanced by sort of outside use of cannabis?
Well, again, the cannabis plant, when you consume that, all it's really doing is mimicking the compounds that you make. What becomes important, really, though, is that as we get older and as we start to accumulate these damages and start to suffer from them, the cannabinoids, on the one hand, reduce the free radicals that are produced, but which lead to these different diseases, but they also then wind up relieving a lot of the symptomology. So there's two aspects here. It's very important to understand. They're not only simply relieving symptoms, but they actually prevent, reduce the severity and the onset time of, prolong the onset time, rather, of all of these age-related diseases. And what we're discovering more and more now, and I mean literally every day there's new papers coming out, the field has exploded so much that it's very hard for me to even keep up with it. Hmm. But just to show you how dramatic it can be, the endocannabinoids have been shown to protect the heart when the heart gets deprived of oxygen, which is what happens when you have a heart attack. They protect your brain if your brain has, for example, a stroke or a head injury.
Well, now, this is one of the things that Dean Becker began the interview with, was by his, I guess his mother had just passed away. Dean Becker is, for our listeners, the host of Cultural Baggage. His mother had just passed away from a stroke, and he said that it was recommended to give a stroke patient or a stroke victim some cannabis immediately after their stroke to decrease the brain swelling?
It decreases the brain swelling, yeah. So, see, what happens is, you know, our body, the real characteristic of life is organization. And in order to have organization, you have to have communication, right? And that means that our cells are all communicating with one another to try and work efficiently together to allow us to live. And if you have a stroke, the brain cells that are in the area where the damage initiated, they communicate to the immune system and that there's a problem, and then the immune system comes into play, and what winds up doing in the case of a head injury or stroke is it generates inflammation, and that inflammation in turn winds up killing nerve cells. So there's, again, a dual role here for the way marijuana and cannabinoids that you make work. They balance, remember the idea of a thermostat again, yeah. They balance two arms of your immune system. Your immune system has an inflammatory arm, which is very essential for fighting off all sorts of diseases, but it has to be turned down in order to protect your cells that are in the vicinity of what the immune system is trying to fight off. In other words, it's kind of like using a little nuclear weapon. We make free radicals from our immune system to basically sanitize areas from infection. But in doing that, it causes collateral damage. So we don't want it to be too strong, so your body, you know, turns it on, turns it off, turns it on, turns it off, just like the thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the injury, the inflammation comes, and then the cannabinoids come to try and turn it down. So that's one aspect as to how they wind up protecting your brain. But on the other hand, they have a very interesting property of actually directly protecting nerve cells. So that the nerve cells that might be dying as a result of, say, inflammation, become protected from dying. And this is part of why marijuana has a beneficial effect for glaucoma. It's not simply that it reduces the intraocular pressure, the pressure within the eye, but it actually winds up protecting the retina and the optic nerve, which are all covered with cannabinoid receptors, because of the way the cannabinoids, when they bind to those receptors, change the biochemistry so that those cells are less prone to dying.
So the way in which cannabinoids and cannabis work in terms of this whole mimicking thing, I was wondering if there could be like an analogy drawn between, for example, if you have like a woman who is overdue in terms of, she's pregnant and she's overdue in terms of delivering, and what'll happen sometimes if, you know, she's 2 weeks overdue or something, is that the doctor will give her a shot of something that mimics the hormone that induces labor, and because
exactly.
The body has a receptor for that hormone, it recognizes it as her going into labor or the signal to go into labor, and then the body will, even though it's not the real hormone, but it's mimicking
exactly.
it.
Exactly. It's very similar to that, yes.
Okay.
And actually, you know, as I said, the cannabinoids are involved in everything in our body practically, all right? So every system in our body, meaning our digestive system, our respiratory system, our cardiovascular system, our nervous system, our endocrine system, our skeletal system, our reproductive system, those are all regulated by cannabinoids. So in a woman, for example, her uterus is loaded with THC receptors, and she makes a ton of endocannabinoids, turned down for implantation. So in other words, during ovulation, which is when you're capable of, obviously having sperm and egg meet, it's during that time that the sperm and egg, once they've formed a zygote, they have to implant into the uterus wall. And for that implantation to succeed properly, you have to turn down the THC levels, or the endocannabinoid levels, because it turns out that that inflammatory process is required for that implantation. Hmm. So a woman naturally has high levels and low levels that fluctuate with the menstrual cycle. And that's probably why excessive use of cannabis can have an effect on pregnancy. Mm-hmm. It's also why, remember, everybody, we're all basically the same, right? We're all human beings, but we all have slight variations on our genes. Our genes are not exactly identical, and depending on the differences, we become more or less susceptible to different kinds of imbalances. And in the case of the cannabinoids that we make, we have to look at what the system really is. We have something that makes these cannabinoids, all right? And then those cannabinoids bind to the THC or to the cannabinoid receptors, but then they also have to be broken down, because if you couldn't turn them on and turn them off, you wouldn't have a switch, right? So you couldn't regulate things if they were just always on or if they were just always off. You have to be able to respond to your environment, and the environment could be just the environment of a cell, for example. And you have to be able to turn them on and turn them off. So we break them down as well. And it turns out that one of the few things that's been associated with spontaneous abortions is a change in the gene that's responsible for breaking down our endocannabinoids so that the levels are higher in these individuals, and that actually promotes spontaneous abortions.
The level of what is higher? Cannabinoids?
The level is higher of the cannabinoids because of a change in the one of the enzymes that breaks down the cannabinoids.
Well, I know when my daughter was born, we had a false labor. We went to the hospital, mm-hmm. and the nurse, when they figured out it was a false labor, the nurse asked us, "Did we just have sex, or did we just smoke marijuana?" She realized that marijuana could be a trigger for labor or for false labor. So yeah,
as an interesting extension of that story, this is just shows how profound the involvement of this system is in everyone's lives, whether they know it or not. Cannabinoids are in mother's milk. And because we now have developed as research tools ways to mimic the THC itself or the endocannabinoids with synthetics, as I mentioned, we also have developed other compounds that will actually turn off the system. So the ones that turn on the system are called agonists, and the ones that turn off the system are called antagonists. And if you take a newborn mouse and you treat them with an antagonist so that THC or endocannabinoids cannot work, the newborn mice starve to death because they never eat.
Because I've got some of your notes here. It's because they've been fed through the umbilical cord for so long, they never learned how to eat.
Right.
And go on.
Yeah, so they have a natural suckling response, and then they wind up suckling on the mother. The mother gives the milk, and in the milk, the mother's got some of the natural dope that her body produced, and that gives the kid the munchies.
That's amazing.
It is. Well, what becomes even more incredible is that every time every one of us, meaning, George Bush and all these other drug warriors, every time they get hungry because a little part of their brain makes some of these endocannabinoids that goes to another part of their brain, and they basically are giving themselves the munchies. That's how we all work.
Wow.
Wow. I just want to break for about 10 seconds here and remind people that they are listening to CHLY. This is FM 101.7. You're listening to Elephant Talk, and we are speaking with Dr. Robert Melamed, the chairman of the biology department, the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. Now, one of the other things that I wanted to touch on is, well, I want to ask actually as well, what sort of distinction does the body make between cannabis that we that you might eat or smoke and endocannabinoids? Does it tell the difference?
Well, there are ultimately some differences that must occur because the chemicals are different. But in terms of how your body responds when the THC molecule binds to the receptor, that should be pretty much very similar. Breakdown products are going to be different, and it turns out that a lot of the breakdown products from your endocannabinoids are also biologically active. You know, again, the idea of communication and how important it is and how sophisticated it is. So we start with, an endocannabinoid, and we break it down, and then those breakdown products, they wind up doing other things and communicating in other ways, which actually brings up a very interesting story. So one of the things that's been known for a long time is that we have a particular enzyme called cyclooxygenase. It's more commonly known to the public as COX, COX-1 and COX-2. There's two different versions of this enzyme. And it's been known for a number of years that that's how aspirin works, because aspirin binds to the COX enzyme and inhibits it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that that's what Celebrex and all of these other anti-inflammatories do, these COX-2-specific inhibitors that we've heard a lot about in the news recently.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they're pain relievers for people with arthritis, because they reduce swelling and they help prevent the degradation to some degree.
Mm.
But what they found now is that there's been an increase in cardiovascular problems, heart attacks resulting from it. So why is that? Well, it turns out that the chemical that normally feeds into that biochemical pathway that the COX enzymes work on, that those chemicals, for years it's been known that there's a whole inflammatory set of chemicals that are being made. But what's now known is also our endocannabinoids go through that pathway. So when you shut that pathway down, you start to shut down some of the effects of the endocannabinoids, which, as I mentioned earlier, include protecting the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what they've done with those COX-2 inhibitors is they've shut down inflammatory compounds, and they've helped the arthritic condition, but they've also shut down endocannabinoids and reduced protection for the heart. So probably a wiser approach rather would have been to restore the balance. Again, the idea of balance. There's pro-inflammatory compounds that are made by this COX-2, and there's anti-inflammatory compounds, and the anti-inflammatory compounds are the cannabinoids. So instead of shutting down the whole pathway, it makes much more sense to me that you consume cannabis.
One thing I'm wondering about is what the possible drawbacks are, because I'm wondering if there's a connection, for example, between when someone ingests heroin or ecstasy or something, that it's possibly mimicking something like serotonin, so that you get this pleasurable response because your body thinks that it's serotonin, or I can't remember what the other chemical is that it kind of mimics. So, but there is, of course, we know, drawbacks to using those kinds of drugs, because in other ways they do inhibit your health. So have you found any sort of side effect sort of things?
Again, everything has pros and cons, so let's not make believe that everything with marijuana is good, because that's not true. But in general, it has a lot more positive effects the negative effects, because of how it affects these free radicals and these anti-aging properties. We're all suffering from this terminal disease called aging. And cannabinoids are basically anti-aging compounds. But, of course, we all have known people, and it certainly is a minority, but we all know, the typical stereotype stoner, the person who does nothing but sit around and smoke dope all the time and doesn't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, 5 or 10% of the population that smokes marijuana.
At the most, yeah.
Yeah. So there is that aspect to it, to that minority portion of the population.
And then there's people who eat so many carrots they turn yellow, but carrots are still pretty good for you.
Yeah. Well, that's the idea. You have to do things in balance, and you have to know what your needs are, and you know, be wise about things, as opposed to the government's attitude, which is that there is no, first of all, the statement that DEA says that there's no medical value to marijuana, that's just insanity.
And they know it's a lie. They must.
Well, it's a complete lie. This stuff is regulating everything in your body. How could it have no value?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just total lunacy.
But the I think, and what Julia was asking is that, for instance, with opiates replace the chemical in that your brain produces for feelings of well-being to the point that your brain stops producing it. But cannabis won't do that, right?
There are some very fundamental differences between how cannabis does these things and how the opiates do. You hit it right on the head. When you consume external opiates, because the reason opiates work are also because we have receptors, and we also make internal opiates called endorphins.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So it turns out when you take them from the outside, you turn off the internal production.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you don't have it, now you've got a vacuum, a chemical vacuum, okay? And that's what gives these people the sickness and the addictiveness. In the case of pot, what happens is you actually turn down the THC receptors if you consume too much. That's why people, if they take too much, they don't get high anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep doing low doses, you can stay high forever. You know, you can keep getting high as opposed to blowing it by over-consuming.
Right.
So there have been studies, and one of the characteristics of an addictive drug is that an animal will self-administer it.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, cocaine, they put a little needle in the brain, and they allow the mouse or the rat to press a lever, or a monkey, and they'll just keep pressing forever. They will not stop to eat. They will not stop for sex. So that's a highly addictive drug,
mm-hmm.
all right? And for years, they wanted to show, you know, how bad marijuana was, but they couldn't show that animals would self-administer.
Hmm.
So recently, they've developed a model with the squirrel monkeys where they were able to show self-administration. Big deal now. Now people could say it's an addictive drug. Well, if you look at the data and you look at how much the monkey will self-administer, it's only in a very defined range. In other words, it won't take too much.
Huh.
And if you translate that range based on how much they gave the mouse and how big the mouse is, and you translate it up to a human, it turns out to be about 2 drags.
Okay. So just
you know,
enough to...
I mean, think of it. We all know people who use marijuana, right? How many of these people will sit there and smoke and smoke and smoke and smoke and not stop or eat more and more? If you take too much, what happens? You go to sleep.
Yeah.
Mm. You know?
Highly dangerous.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting because you're kind of clarifying something I was thinking, which is like, well, if this is so good, like, what about those people that I know that are total potheads that don't seem to really be that healthy or happy or something? But I can see what you mean. I mean, anything.
It might not be the potheadedness that is making them unhappy. That might just be a mask for everything.
Yeah, and it's the overuse.
To relieve other symptoms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One other little thing I just wanted to ask about, just like a clarification, does cannabinoids have an effect on your metabolism as well? Because I've noticed a lot of people that smoke pot seem to be able to get the munchies and eat quite a lot, but not necessarily get really fat. Like, this is just a theory of my own.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. You know, it does seem, and it's not been clarified to my satisfaction. I've not been able to dissect this to a point where I'm comfortable with understanding it at the level I'd like to, okay? But I agree with what you're saying. It seems that seems to be true. Now, we know that cannabinoids can enhance glucose metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can foster the burning of sugar. But what we've discovered over the past 2 years, and in fact, a friend of mine and myself have started a company on this, is cells can either be feeding their, what's called their mitochondria. These are like energy-producing factories within our cells.
Mm-hmm.
If you're feeding them carbohydrates and the carbohydrates are being burnt, it's a different effect than when the cells are burning fats. So, obviously, if you're burning fats, you're not going to be storing fat, and therefore you're going to be thinner.
Hmm.
All right? So it seems to me that THC should promote burning of fat.
Hmm.
But yet there's other evidence that indicates otherwise. So it's a complicated picture because part of what we've discovered is that when cells are burning fat, they wind up becoming very resistant to dying. Whereas when cells are burning sugars, they wind up producing a whole lot of free radicals, and it's much easier for those cells to die and much easier for the immune system to see them and to kill them as well. So there's all sorts of implications here for autoimmune diseases as well as for cancer, which is why we've started this company. And what I've been doing for my own research in my laboratory is to try to discover more of that link between what's going on with THC in different, or cannabinoids, because I can't use THC. That would require a permit that they might not like to give me. But I can buy stuff that's 100 times more powerful over the net and have it delivered 2 days later.
Yeah.
that specific... See, there's two different kinds of cannabinoid receptors. There's what's known as CB1 and CB2. And the CB2 is specific for the immune system. Whereas the CB1 is more general and is certainly the one that's in our brains and in our nervous system.
There's lab rats or mice, I understand, where they remove the CB1 receptors.
Yes.
And so what? And something interesting happens to those mice, right? What can you talk about that?
A couple of interesting things. In one of the two strains, and again, this points to the difference between things that look to be the same, but yet we're still subtly different, you know, why each of us is an individual as opposed to a clone. In one of the knockout mice, as they're called, the mice actually die prematurely, which tells you that you need your cannabinoids in order to live properly. Again, because you wind up aging prematurely because you're making too many free radicals.
Yeah, okay, right.
Right? But the other thing they noticed about these mice, and this is incredibly interesting, is that they just cannot deal with change. And that was noticed by the fact that when you pick up one of these mice and you put him down again, he's all freaked out because you moved him. You know, moving from one side of the cage to the other was like an incredibly stressful event because there was too much change.
Wow.
So follow-up studies on that, because that was so obvious that they were stressing out from any kind of handling or movement or anything, was an experiment done with something known as a Morris water maze. So it's a maze, and the mice are put in the maze, and rodents in general don't like swimming. They don't like water.
Yeah.
So they kind of freak out, and they swim around until they find a platform that's in this maze. And then if you take them out and you put them in the maze again, they'll go right to the platform. So if you take normal mice or if you take the wild or the knockout mice, either type will have the same response when you first put them in. They'll freak out. They'll discover the platform. If you take them out and put them back in, they'll learn where that platform is and they'll go right to the platform. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So both mice, the wild-type mice, the normal mice with intact THC cannabinoid systems, as well as the knockouts that cannot respond because you've inhibited their, you've eliminated their receptor, basically, all right? Both of those are able to learn the route in the maze, okay? Now, if you change the position of the maze after you've trained the mouse as to where it was, you pick the normal mice and you put them in. They go to where the platform used to be. It's not there. They freak out. They explore again, and now they find where the platform is. And if you take them out and put them in again, they'll go right to the new place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best way to get out, right?
Right.
You do the same thing with the knockout mice, the ones that don't have any cannabinoid receptor. And you put them in. They go, they find the platform's missing, they freak out, they explore, they find the new place, you take them out, and you put them back in, they go to the old place instead of the new place.
Huh.
They can't be rewired. It's kind of like, you know, our drug czar, who's been taught as a child that marijuana is no good, and then all the science comes out that tells him, well, it's got to have some medical value, it's impossible not to have medical. No, we can't learn that. Because that would be learning something new.
So all we got to do is get a couple of drug czars high, and we might be on the road.
Well, if they have defective receptors, they may not be able to get high.
Maybe they've had lobotomies and like removed their receptors.
So this leads me to, you know, for years I've been trying to understand how can this insanity be going on for so long. Because when I was, you know, a young kid and I started smoking marijuana when I was 16 years old, when I first started college, You know, as I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, you know, marijuana, everybody was smoking it, and you thought for sure that this was going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, the repression came again.
Yeah.
And how, you know, I'm one of these pathologically curious people about everything, trying to understand how could that have happened.
Yeah.
The repression.
So I now finally have an explanation that makes sense to me. So since we all have these cannabinoid systems, that can either be high level or low level, right? Some people are going to be better endowed than others.
Hmm.
All right?
Okay,
so you're going to have an average in the population, and some people are going to be below the average, and other people are going to be above the average. That's inevitable, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I would say that the people that are below average in their cannabinoid system are the people who cannot tolerate change, who look backwards to some illusion of the past glory that they, you know, think about. whereas the people who are more open-minded, they look into the future. They're not afraid of change. They don't know what the future is going to bring, but they, you know, they're looking forward to it, the next challenge, so to speak.
More easygoing, generally.
Yeah, so I think that we have a population that's divided like that, and that's inevitable. And I think that the people that are backward-looking, who I call the more primitive people, and we need both, because you need this balancing act again, right?
But why is it that they're the ones that are running the world?
Well, that's what I'm just about to say. If you have a whole bunch of people who are looking backwards, they're looking at what already happened. If you have a bunch of people who are forward-looking, they're looking into the future. They don't know what's going to happen. Who's more likely to be in agreement? The backward-looking people.
Mm.
Who's more likely to get in the government because they have consensus?
Mm.
The backward-looking people.
Hmm.
Right.
That's a really good point.
So I think what we're really looking at here is, you know, evolution in action here. Because what has happened is if you look at the THC receptors in the brains, as you look up the evolutionary tree, you see that man has more of these receptors, and they're in the more evolutionarily advanced areas of our brain. So evolution
more receptors than who, say?
Than a more primitive animal.
Okay, right. Because all animals have them, right?
Yes. Everything except for insects has them, pretty much.
Wow. Okay,
So as we go up, we see that the cannabinoids have been selected for again and again, which is why they participate in everything, in regulating everything. And we see an expansion of their use in the areas of our brain involved with higher functioning, which means that we're going to be, you know, if the trend continues, we're going to be more stoned naturally as mankind progresses over time. So this brings up another interesting point. 100 years ago in you know, Canada or in the U.S., where we have a decent level of public health nowadays, 100 years ago, most people were dying from infectious diseases. And many of these infectious diseases can be better fought by that pro-inflammatory arm of the immune system. Well, that same arm is the one that's also responsible for all of these age-related diseases. All right, so as we got better public health and we developed antibiotics, et cetera, we're living longer because we're eliminating those more of those infectious diseases, okay? But now we're still making too many free radicals because we had needed them so much in, you know, so much in the past for those inflammatory, for those infectious diseases. What we have to do now is make less of them in order to be able to live longer.
Mm.
So evolution can't work that fast. So what's the solution? Make sure you take in essential fatty acids so your body can make your endocannabinoids, and also to use cannabis as necessary.
I think there's a good point what you said about more people becoming stoned naturally or whatever, because I think of, like, when I was a teenager smoking pot for the first time or something, and all of these incredible apocalyptic ideas come to you, and you're like, oh my god, I've never thought this way before. And then as you go on in your life, like, I don't really use marijuana anymore, but as you go on in your life, it becomes that those kinds of thoughts are very normal, and you understand them now, and you've explored them. And so it very naturally, it is like you become, your everyday life becomes like that first time that you got stoned. You think that way all the time, you know.
Yes,
there is a natural progression that I've noticed.
No, I think that you hit, again, the nail right on the head. That's very true. And I think that there's a general trend among people that marijuana, you use it initially as a recreational drug, but you find out that it opens your mind up. And as you take advantage of altered perceptions and new ways of thinking, it can acquire more of a religious tone because of how it's recentered you.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you get older and you start to acquire these biochemical imbalances, at that point it becomes medicinal.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I have a friend, a woman that was, I guess, in her middle 30s in the 1960s, and she, at the time, was of the belief that heroin was the same as marijuana and cocaine, and that all illicit drugs were one and the same. And she,
well, that's what our governments try to tell us.
Exactly.
They keep peddling that lie.
Exactly. And she had never, of course, tried marijuana, and then I guess she had a roommate who smoked it. And she ended up trying it and was, you know, converted and realized one of the things she said to me was that she really believed that marijuana was one of the reasons that there was that the so-called, and I hate this term, but we'll use it anyway, dropout culture in the 60s, that people were able to take an objective look at the rat race. And the sort of the push of, you know, the capitalist way, going to work, the suit and tie, and say, like, this is ridiculous, you know, we don't need this, and to sort of look for other things. And that she really thought it was a great benefit to her and her life. And
I think there are many, many people who feel that all the time. Because, you know, there's nothing like kind of opening your mind up and realizing things. You know, it's very satisfying to all of a sudden learn something new and to change your to change your mind, as long as you're biochemically wired to do that.
and science bears this out, right?
As far as everything I know, yes.
Yeah, and just to remind listeners that might have just tuned in, we are speaking with Dr. Robert Malamede, chair of the biology department, University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. One last thing I just want to get to here, we're going to have to wrap up in a couple of minutes, is that one of the things that you mentioned is that cannabis, like we are told, I think we're still told this, that marijuana kills brain cells. But there is not, there's some truth to that, but it's a little bit, it's not quite what we think. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of experiments where in those experimental conditions they've been able to demonstrate some killing. But in general, it's exactly the opposite. What marijuana and what cannabinoids do in general is they protect nerve cells from dying. So it's the exact opposite of what we've been told. And, you know, the situation is so profound there's a couple of points I'd like to make, if I may.
Please.
One is that marijuana is not always good. There are certain times when it's going to be very bad. For example, with certain kinds of infectious diseases like tuberculosis, leishmania, Legionella's disease, leprosy, those diseases, marijuana would promote the negative effects of those diseases. All right, because of the way the immune system works and what's required to fight those diseases.
Okay.
I think that it's also possible and probable that a subset of the population is predisposed to schizophrenia, where there's a family history or there's other genetic evidence to suggest that these people have a problem, that marijuana could be bad for them. So those are two things that I believe to be true. I think excessive use could affect fertility for the reasons I've already discussed. But again, I've been smoking it for 41 years, and I have 4 kids and 2 grandkids, etc. So again, it's a matter of using your head about things. But on the other side, what has been shown now is that THC in marijuana actually kills a variety of cancer cells.
And those are some of the.
It's not just that it's useful in cancer for nausea. But it's been shown, and again, this is in a variety of experimental conditions, so it's not an absolute end-all, once again, but it shows you a direction. It's been shown to kill glioma, which is a form of brain cancer. You inject THC into the tumor directly, and 3 days later, the tumor is gone.
Huh. Unbelievable.
You know, not in all cases, but in enough that there was a clinical trial in Spain to investigate this, and there's going to be more eventually. Also, they've been shown to kill breast cancer, prostate cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, skin cancer. So there's a lot of potential here for cancer therapy, not just for relieving nausea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing that seems to be kind of cool about it is that, unlike a lot of other drugs, there isn't that much risk of really bad side effects. Like, if you injected it into a tumor and it didn't work, chances are it's not really going to do anything bad to you anyway. You know, it's kind of like a no-lose option.
Well, in this case, in the glioma situation, they injected it into the brain of mice that had these tumors transplanted. And 3 days later, in 30% of the mice had were survivors as opposed to being dead like their untreated counterparts or the variety of the counterparts that didn't work in.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that one of the important functions that occurs when a cancer is growing is that you have to have a blood supply for that tumor. And one of the compounds that's been of major interest for pharmaceutical companies over the years is to develop drugs that inhibit a compound that our bodies make called VEGF, and that stands for vascular endothelial growth factor. In other words, it makes new blood vessels. So if you can inhibit the blood vessels, you can inhibit the tumors. And what they found in this very small clinical trial that was done in Spain with glioma people was that it was inhibiting their VEGFs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's just a whole tremendous world waiting out there for use of cannabinoids in a variety of different pathological conditions. And I think we have an awful lot to learn, but when somebody says there's no medical value, you're dealing with people who have either completely uneducated or they have some kind of twisted agenda.
Mm-hmm. Or they have no CB1 receptors.
Yeah.
But there's hope for these people, right? Like a little bit of cannabis could get them sort of back
on
track.
They have functional receptors.
Oh, right. Okay. Well.
Yeah, so we're dealing with a genetic battle here.
Yeah.
The future versus the past. Which way do you want to go?
Forward or backwards?
And you know, something also I should mention, because people often mention capitalism and the greed of capitalism. I agree that we've been in a very greedy capitalist world. But on the other hand, capitalism very much mimics the evolutionary process, the selection process. The problem with capitalism is not the process, but rather the people that are involved. If we have a bunch of greedy people that are, you know, skimming all the cream and not the sharing, then you have the negative effects of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
But capitalism in itself, if it was carried out by conscious, sharing, loving people, would create really the world of the future.
Hear, hear. Well, Dr. Malamede, it's been really great to talk to you, I must say, and thanks very much for taking the time out this morning.
My pleasure. And
away
anytime.
From your family on this Saturday, and let's keep up the good work. Thank you very
right,
much.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
All right.
Bye bye.
So once again, that was Dr. Robert J. Malamede, and he is the chair of the biology department, the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. He's written a whole bunch of things and on a variety of subjects, of course. But one of his passions is this study of cannabinoids.
Well, it's very enlightening. I mean, I can understand why it'd be a bit of a passion.
Yeah,
if you've discovered
it's wild.
This and
one of the other things, there's a whole bunch of there's all kinds of things here. Seizures are controlled by marijuana, not only THC but non-psychoactive cannabinoidal. And also one of the things that we didn't get to with the brain cells is that not only do marijuana does the cannabinoids, it says here, cannabinoids do kill brain cells, but the brain cells they kill are called glioma, or cancer of the brain. All other brain cells are protected and healed by cannabinoids.
Wow.
Furthermore, brain cells, contrary to what I was told for years by the drug czar warrior types, brain cells can grow or reproduce, right? Like, we were always told that drugs kill brain cells, and brain cells, once they're dead, that's it. They don't grow back, right? But not only do brain cells actually regenerate or reproduce or whatever, but cannabinoids help in that regrowth of brain cells.
Yeah, what frustrates me about what you're just saying, the drugs are warrior types. What bugs me is that it wouldn't be so bad if they were just against all drugs, but it's the hypocrisy of this thing of like, oh, okay, well, government legislated pharmaceutical drugs, which are super harmful as well, especially in combinations, kill all kinds of people and cause
always,
all kinds of problems.
Always the most addictive as well.
Yeah, those are the ones abused. That are promoted and seen as legal and totally different, although they are also drugs. And then it's just this whole thing of whatever the government has decided is illegal, yeah, is a drug.
It's a paradox.